So here on our third week, I give you Steve.
Hi, everybody. My name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic. Week three. Good to be back. Let's kind of have to recenter myself and kind of get some get myself centered back around where we're at in this process. My home group is the Common Solution Group. We meet Monday nights in Princeton, New Jersey. We are a hybrid version right now, but we do meet at Trinity Church on 33 Mercer Street in Princeton, New Jersey on Monday nights from 7:30 to 8:45 p.m. Do come see us if you happen to be in that area on a Monday night. My sobriety date is April 18th of 2014. I introduced myself a little bit to you guys the first week. We covered the first three steps last week. There was a couple new guys in the room, so I spent a little bit more time on step one and felt a little bit rushed through step three. But we looked at step one and the phenomenon of craving. That is the distinguishing characteristic that makes me alcoholic, which means, can I control the amount I am going to drink once I start? And I failed that with flying colors. And the big thing I used to hold on to was it didn't happen every time. And I thought I had some type of power behind that. And my sponsor had pointed out, Steve, are you the one in control of when you can and when you can't do that? And he took the power right out from under me again. I was like, no, then you're powerless. And once I stop, can I manage the decision to stay stopped? And I found that the same voice that always told me to put the drink down was the same voice that told me to pick the drink back up. And it was because I was so restless, irritable, and discontented, this spiritual malady that we talked about. And our book goes, 53 pages explaining to us that this is a terminal illness and this alcoholic cycle, unless arrested by a power greater than myself, I will stay in and I will drink until I got to stop, and I will stop until I got to drink, and it's fatal and it's terminal. And the big thing that scared me wasn't the fact that I was going to, I drank and drove a lot. I was mixing booze and drugs. I wasn't afraid of dying or anything like that. The thing that scared me was living the way I was living, feeling the way I was feeling, if I was going to stay alive for, say, 40 more years feeling like that. That scared the absolute hell out of me. And as I slowly started to burn my life to the ground and watched all the worthwhile relationships and jobs and things like that that I had in my life slowly start to be absorbed by this illness, I was squarely confronted with this question of faith, this step two proposition here, this power greater than myself. And when I had come in here, I had had a lot of issues about religion and all this stuff, and had a mixed experience growing up with abuse and take my advice, I'm not using it, and we go to church and we do this thing, but yet when we go home we act this way, and I had a big problem with that. So if that was what this step two and what this solution was, you can have it. I'm not going there again. And step two just basically said, hey, let's leave the gun on the table. Let's be willing to keep an open mind and have a new experience. Set your compass in this direction and take some steps and have an experience in the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. And that certainly has been my experience. And it's, as a result of this, has allowed me to establish a relationship with a higher power. When we got to step three, I realized that I had missed a huge piece of work in this. I thought the step three was the prayer, and okay, we all high five when we go make the decision to do the rest of the steps. And as I started to go through this process with Katie and Charlie, and I started to realize that there were two requirements, that life based on self-will can hardly be a success, and then they went on to explain to me what that would look like, what an unsurrendered life looks like. And I started to see that that I was trying to manage my life at every turn, and I was trying to manipulate my way through situations to get what I wanted. Now, I could either be the nice guy or, good cop, bad cop kind of thing. I'd have to figure out how I'd have to handle you in order to get what I wanted. But I was being driven by my motives, right? These characters that I didn't know I had yet. And I remember going to a lot of meetings, and there were certain things that they would read in meetings that would absolutely drive me up a wall. One of them was this little thing called acceptance. That thing on page 417 where they go, and acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Used to drive me up a wall. And then I'd come to meetings, and it would be an open discussion meetings, and we'd have these rehabs, and people come in, and they would inadvertently ask one of the new people to come up and share, and the topic would always be gratitude. And I was not very grateful on the far side of this process. The other thing I used to hear that used to make me bristle was the spiritual axiom. It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. And the reason these things used to drive me up a wall is because I knew they were absolutely true, but I didn't know how or why, because I hadn't learned inventory yet. And I actually had looked up the word axiom over the pandemic, and axiom is a self-evident truth or proposition whose truth is so evident at first sight that no process of reasoning or demonstration can make it plainer. Talk about hitting you in the face with some truth. That was definitely my experience with it. So as I go through this process of step three and I start to look at these requirements, and on page 62, they tell me what the root of my problem is. They start lining me out on the need to write inventory, that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problems, not vodka, that my troubles are basically of my own making. And we talked about how that's the great statement of hope. And the fact that things are of my making, that means I can get free of them because there's something I can do about it. And I just have to get to a different perspective. Because when I came in here, the only perspective I was looking at was like my life through a straw. And I couldn't see anything around it. I could only see what you did and how I wasn't getting what I wanted or getting what I needed. And then I have to make this deal, this second requirement that God's going to be the director and I'm going to be the actor. He's the principal, I'm the agent. And they say when I sincerely take this position, all sorts of remarkable things will follow. I'm going to have a new employer, and being all powerful, he's going to provide what I need if I keep close to him and perform his work well. Now, I can't keep close to this power unless I get close to this power, and I can't get close to this power if I'm blocked. Now we have to look at the three most popular and number one, two, and three inventories that we'll pick up a drink over, which is resentment, fear, and our sex conduct. So it says, established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. So it's telling us that it's not going to be completely gone, and being selfless is never totally implied. So I'm going to kind of, live with this type level of disturbance on some level for the rest of my life. Otherwise, what good am I to the newcomer? I have to keep, this assures me that I'm going to struggle with some levels of self that will require me to keep turning to this power and keep practicing this program at a deeper level and keep growing. Because remember, if I fail to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life, my experience shows me I pick up a drink. So it says down here at the bottom of page 63, next we launched on a course of vigorous action, which is steps 4 through 9, the first of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision, our third step decision, was a vital and crucial step. It could have little permanent effect unless at once. So we've got next and at once. That's when we start writing the inventory after we get up off our knees from the third step prayer, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of, right, the things in our lives which have been blocking us. So that's kind of a little promise right there. We get to, even though we, none of this stuff, everybody freaks out when we come to inventory, and there's not a thing that's on your inventory that you don't already know, right? And everybody runs away from this process, and this is the one where most new guys, in my experience, relapse, and the other ones amends. And what's crazy is this thing here, it's like, I don't know if it's, the writing it out and having to kind of, deal with this stuff again and not have the ability to, or actually tell it to somebody. You know, somewhere in between those two is where we lose people. So it says, our liquor was but a symptom, right? So we had to get down to causes and conditions. And this whole thing of the symptom is like, man, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problems. Now I got to get down below the surface to find out where these manifestations of self are coming from. So it says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding. That's the sponsor's job, and a fact-facing process, the sponsee's job. I always liked it, heard it put like the sponsor brings the flashlight, the sponsee brings the shovel, right? It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. This is the why. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. Interesting use of words there. Values isn't just monetary values, but think about family values, our belief systems. You know, it's kind of alluding to a deeper, yep, this is what they did, this is how it affected me, but I got to understand how and why, and I'll explain more when we get to the third column. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. I mean, that's what we got to really dig into. We got to do this at a level where we, like the first 100, where we become convinced that this is what defeated us, right? So we considered its common manifestations. Common manifestation number one, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've got the mental obsession and the phenomenon of craving. We had been spiritually sick. So there's the three elements of our illness, three elements of our recovery. The three sides of the triangle. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Asked ourselves why we were angry, which is column two. So when I'm lining out a new guy on inventory, I'll basically just say, anybody who you have a resentment toward, anybody you're disappointed in, let you down, picked on you, anything that can come off as, like, say, a low-grade form of resentment. Because people always, like, use the word resentment. Well, I don't have a resentment. And I'm like, well, how about pisses me off, disappoints me? Those are low-grade resentments, right? So just whatever comes to your mind that you couldn't jump in the car with and get on a ride to Atlantic City with, where that would be a little uncomfortable, just put them on the list. Right? Write a name, skip a line, and just follow that process. When it's done, it's done. And if you have to add more at the end, fine. We don't have to go back to third grade in Mrs. Smith's class and this guy, you know, poked me in the eye or took my pencil. Like, I want to get the stuff that's on you now. Right? This is not going to be the only time you do inventory in your life. I mean, this is, you know, step 10 is steps 4 through 9 daily. Right? So write a name, skip a line, boom. Now, any good alcoholic or drug addict that I know can write this down pretty much in 20 minutes. You know, we got all these guys taking weeks and weeks and weeks. I guarantee you go, all right, what did he do? You know, this is where you get to take their inventory, right? So this is so-and-so did such-and-such, and what I try to tell people to do is it must be specific and it must be the truth, right? You can't put, you know, dad was never there for me. So the day you were born, he left. Well, no. You know, when I was, you know, needed emotional support, sometimes he wasn't available. You know, stuff like that. Be specific. Because what we write in column two is going to determine what we see in column three and four. And we need that to turn column one and two into a lie. Okay, because that's the only way we're going to get free. We have to get to a totally different perspective. So as we go through this process, right, and we get this stuff all down, then we basically get to the point where it says we asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, we found that it was our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, personal relations, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name, our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, or personal or sex relations which had been hurt, which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example, and it goes down through the Mr. Brown examples, which you guys can read. I still love the best AA t-shirt is Mr. Brown Needs His Ass Kicked. Always one of those, like this, the stuff that Mr. Brown did was just ridiculous. And you'll see they've got, you know, some have multiple resentments and things like that. And I just have guys put A, B, or C down there. Because no matter what, even though we're writing these names and skipping a line on what they did, they're all, every resentment, the way I write inventory, the way I teach my guys to write inventory, every resentment's going to get its own sheet. I actually brought some current inventory to read to you guys to kind of show you how it. I'm going to kind of do a kind of a group fifth step here tonight on some of the stuff that happened during the pandemic, which I was just telling Mark, I was reading before I got here. I was like, oh my God, this is, I hadn't read since I 10th stepped it with my sponsor. And I hold on to some of this stuff for reasons like this. So I have the guys, when I'm working with somebody new, I'm not going to have them do an extended third column and have them write their fourth column. I want them to get, to get the first couple columns down and do as much of the just check, almost like sex relations, self-esteem, all these seven areas of self that were affected. Can you see that it affected your ambition, your pride, your pocketbook, your sex relations, security, self-esteem, or personal relations? Because I'm going to help them more with that in a fifth step. I'm going to kind of walk them through that process. Because I, you know, when I came in here, I had one tunnel vision type of thing, and it was usually started out by those bastards, you know, and I couldn't see it from any other angle than how it affected me. Right, so I don't expect a new guy who's lived his whole life that way, treated that that with alcohol and drugs, to be able to see things other than how it's affecting them. Right, so I'll go through that process. I try to get him to do it as quickly as possible, within a couple of weeks. You know, because a lot of these areas of self that are affected, when I'm doing this in a fist up for the first time, I'm going to be writing down their fears next to, because every time one of these manifestations of self are affected. You're going to have a fear associated with it. So the fear inventory, you're almost writing while you are doing the fifth step with this process, right? And there's different ways you can do that as well. You can do it exactly. And like I said, the first time I'm working with somebody, we're going to stick right to the book. Super simple. I'm going to try to explain, if we have enough time, what inventory has come to mean to me, having done it a bunch and having had to do it a bunch. And just how much it's broadened and deepened, much like a prayer and meditation practice. It's become one of the best tools I have in my spiritual toolbox. And I dreaded writing it initially when I first started getting into this process, because I had heard other people say, oh God, inventory. So therefore I had an opinion about an experience I hadn't had, and I hid behind that for a long period of time, and it kept me from writing the inventory. So it kept me from becoming free. So now down here at the end of this, once we get all this stuff down, right, I'll have them move into the fear inventory and, you know, just kind of go down through anything that's scary, not like spiders or heights or stuff like that. More like trying new things, you know, anything where there's a fear associated with it. I'll have them write out that list. Again, we're going to get into more detail as part of the fifth step and things like that. And then I'll line them out on the sex conduct inventory, you know, just there, not like the, you know, the, unless there's like crazy destructive patterns with it, but I'll have them write out like a brief synopsis of the relationship, right, for the sex inventory, and we'll answer the 9 questions on page 69, and I'll line them out on how to write the sex ideal, like, you know, looking at that question, what should I have done instead, as a great starting point for what your sex ideal could be, which I don't have them read to me. I said, that's chosen, that's individual, that's between you and the big guy. But if you start struggling in the sexual arena, I want you to go back to that inventory and look at it, because usually it's a failure of your sex ideal of some kind. So I kind of have them kind of keep that in the background. So once they get all that stuff written out, I try to get a block of time, you know, several hours. I say, we're going to make an appointment. We're going to sit down. We're going to read this this process, right? And we'll go back and I'll have them read the directions. Like when we start getting deeper into the third column here. So it says, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. So it doesn't have to be perfect. The only thing that counts is that you're doing the very best you can and you're as honest as possible during this process. It's not going to be perfect. They're not going to, you know, erect a statue of you and put it in front of GSO for best fourth step ever written kind of thing. You know, most thorough, right? It's a starting point. This is where you learn how to write inventory to see what it's all about. Right, because this is going to be a tool that you're going to use that's going to keep you from the spiritual wood chipper that is your mind, right? And that's what we need to kind of understand that what we're up against here. So it says, when we finished, we considered it carefully. That's not me checking a box, seeing, oh yeah, it affects self-relation, self-esteem, security. Ho hum, just the bastard I thought he was. Because that's one way to make sure you live in resentment and anger. All you do is just stir the pot and move the resentment around, and yep, it affected me just like that. Mm-hmm. Bastards. You know? That kind of stuff. So, the first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Like, I was the best blamer. I was the ultimate blame thrower when I got in here. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumphs were short-lived. Has that been my experience when I look at this stuff? You know, that's the question you have to ask yourself. Now, I like to go through this and do a little exercise with this next paragraph, because there's 7 death threats in it. and think of this consideration. Why would you want to live in a world like this? It is plain to see that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. This business of resentment is infinitely grave. That's a death threat. We found it is fatal. Death threat number 2. For when harboring, meaning which is to nurture, to give a safe place to, such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. There's number 3. If we were to live, so there's number 4, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm, which is, you know, a transient mental outburst or rage, they may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholics, these things are poison. And last time I checked, poison will kill you. That's 5. So we turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. No key, no future. There's number 6. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. That's my saving grace, is a new perspective. Do you see how important this perspective shift is? The ability to see things from an entirely different angle? So much different than just don't drink and go to meetings and think the drink through. That's what I came in here on, and I wondered why I was miserable. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. So we don't have many problems when we get here. Just the world and all of its people. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, this is the part that blew my mind, fancied or real, which means it doesn't even have to be true or happening. I can go through a scenario in my head, feel the same feelings, and it has the power to kill me just like something that real does, because I'll drink behind anything, because my mind doesn't know the difference. See, I had to be very careful to never let something get past my awareness that I wasn't willing to experience. So that was death threat number 7, by the way. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. And Bill, in his infinite wisdom, being the ultimate salesman, basically goes through this, probably the greatest sales pitch in the history of the world, because a good salesman will never discuss price before he establishes value. And what's crazy about this is it doesn't matter what the price is, we have to pay it. Are you willing? Do you experience that at this level? Has this been your experience? If you have had this step one experience that they're talking about, where's the choice? And all of a sudden, when you start to realize the depth and weight and of resentment and getting free of this stuff, all of a sudden I'd run to inventory because this stuff is like that fire-breathing dragon that's on me. And it's around every corner. And I just think I'm going to just not drink and go to meetings and, you know, get a coffee commitment and survive on the spirituality I get from meetings like Voldemort living off of unicorn blood. It's just not going to happen. I'm not going to be able to get the needed power to grow beyond this spiritual malady. And the malady is going to take me down every time because it keeps progressing. You know, it's a progressive. So is recovery. So is the spiritual aspect of this. If I keep putting stuff into this process, I kind of outpace the malady where I can actually feel happy, joyous, and free. Because I don't know about you guys. I knew there was a lot more to get out of drugs and alcohol than just sitting at the bar and crying in my beer. I always tried to get there. There was a sweet spot with the right amount of drugs, the right amount of drinking, the right people, the right ambiance, the right atmosphere. And if it wasn't there, I'd find the place that it was. Right? And then there's people that, you know, just sit there and cry in their beer and go home and go to sleep. That's kind of like just don't drink and go to meetings to me. I could not get well in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous doing that. And if you can, great. I just wasn't that type of alcoholic. Right? It's not that people were trying to keep it from me. It's just I needed something more than I was experiencing. See, my choices in recovery became a function of my options. You know, and I didn't have the options that this book was talking about. I wasn't going to meetings where they were talking about this. This wasn't a big thing back in the 90s where we were going to speaker meetings and people were actually talking about living a program. You know, and that's how I ended up dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and 12 years dry, picked up a drink. It took me 6 years to put it down, and it took me 18 years to ever find out what I suffered from. That's scary. Could you imagine going to a doctor, and for 18 years you just kind of keep fumbling around through the waiting room, and you never really get a diagnosis that makes sense to you or a way to solve it? That was my experience. It's crazy. So this was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. So now we're kind of transitioning, right? We're starting to, you know, see how it affected us. Now they're starting to shift us to a different perspective. Though we did not like their symptoms, column two, and the way they disturbed us, column three, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Right? It starts to get me to look at something from a perspective of compassion. Right? We ask, this is a prayer directive, we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry, thy will be done. There's a step three reference. Right? Thy will be done. Remember, I'm on a new footing. You know, that step three decision that we made, that deal, the terms of the deal, it restates the deal there. In my lineage, we call this the forgiveness prayer, the sick man prayer. You know, because it helps me. I've heard this called, you know, the fourth column statement of hope, the turnarounds, whatever you want to call them, as long as you do it. I don't care what you call it. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people this way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. Well, that's a different perspective, a different take on things. I'm trying to go in and get mine in a situation and put my helmet on and go to battle. And now I'm looking at it from where can I be helpful? How can I help this person? Right? We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Sounds an awful lot like our 10th step. In our 11th step, evening review, right? This is where we first really get some depth and weight into that because these are the manifestations of self. When I start looking at this stuff, and I'll read you an inventory here in a minute, as to how I show up when Steve is selfish, dishonest, all three forms, self-seeking and frightened. Because that's the stuff I'm going to be watching for my 10th step. And the next five steps come from the truth I see in that column. Pretty important, right? That's why I was so grateful when I got into a lineage where they took this inventory part seriously, like really seriously. Because I get to look at this stuff at a deep level. And that's what it became for me in the beginning, like I said. It was kind of generic. I got, wow, it's a different perspective. I can see it. But when this stuff really started getting teeth for me was as a part of my 10th step. When I went back, and I wasn't worried about picking up a drink. I was dying the death of self-reliance. the second surrender, right? It's not the surrender to alcohol, but the surrender of selfishness and self-centeredness. Because I go back, fall asleep to this process, and I start trying to get mine. You know, where, you know, what can I get at the job? What toys can I get? What, you know, what status can I get in AA, right? Meanwhile, you're just, you know, I'm sitting here putting stock in people basically reading directions to me out of a book, and I can't have their experience. I have to have my own. But I would treat that knowledge as though it was some shiny spiritual trophy that would make me well. And when you hear people tell their story, they're like, man, hey, that dude was messed up. And I'm sitting here trying not to step on his robe. Right? It's not about that. It's not about the people. It's all about the book pointing to this process, because I have to have my own experience. I can't know it. I can't learn it. I have to take the steps, get it on me, find out what it means to me, and have my own experience, and then live it. Or I will be doomed to drink and drug and just wreck my life in a generally miserable fashion, which has been my experience. So, though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we see our faults, we listed them in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. So this is where we start writing our eighth step, right? So then it kind of kicks us right into the fear inventory. And, you know, if we're doing this with a sponsor, we're going to be talking about fear, and I'm going to be talking about motives. Through this 12-step process, I found out a lot about a new guy and his situation and his family. And I start asking about whatever questions I need clarification on when he's reading his resentment inventory to me, so I can make relevant questions. And I kind of let the spirit of whatever it is we're doing kind of guide us. There's a lot of intuition in it after you do this for a while. I've worked with a bunch of guys, and I've heard a lot of fifth steps. And, you know, the first time I work with a guy and I don't know him real well, it's going to be real different after I've known him for several months and done a, you know, 10 steps with him, and I get to see how he shows up on a daily basis. And, and they start explaining it. And my sponsor's really big on, and Katie was really big on this, is you let an alcoholic talk long enough, they're going to step on their tail. They're going to reveal the decision made by self that placed them in that position to be hurt. So I'm a very patient sponsor. I learned that by reading inventory from people who knew how to hear it. And they walked me through this process. And I'll get into some later ones, on some kind of heavy-duty ones that hopefully next week. But so our fear inventory, they get down here to the bottom that this short word touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Fear, or it, set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune which we felt we didn't deserve. But did we not ourselves set the ball rolling? We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And when you do an inventory like this, I mean, the inventory, after you start this process going, almost writes itself. And I can't tell you how many times I've been with sponsees where we've laughed through the inventory process because it was the same person, same resentment with a different face. And you see the exact same patterns over and over and over. This is how self shows up. This is what I have to watch for in step two. This is what I take into my evening review. How did I do with those manifestations of self? Because I have very simple, simple ways that I live my life. I go to work. I have a family. I go to AA. I have sponsees. So there's certain stage characters that show up, right? There's the father. There's the sponsor. There's the employee. And every one of these guys have an old idea, belief systems, and programmings, and every one of these guys have a microphone in my head. And what's crazy is during any situation, I can have one situation happens that affects 3 to 5 stage characters, and it's almost like a kaleidoscope of stage characters in my head that happen all at once. And I can be sitting on the couch, and my wife is talking to me, and I'm literally watching a movie multitasking in my head. And she asked me a question. I'm like, what? And she's like, Jesus, what's the matter with you? I was like, she's like, we're just sitting on the couch. I go, yeah. Yeah, don't you understand? And she's like, doesn't get it. I can say that in a room full of you guys, and you guys are like, yeah, I get that. But you do that at a, you know, at a Little League game, and they start backing away. It's like, this guy's nuts. It's like, you have no idea. So this process opens me up to that, because I start to see, you can't see a picture when you're in it. And this process pulls me off of me enough. And I need guys, you know, like my sponsees, the guys that I talk to in this process, to basically show me, like, hey man, everything all right? Like, and then I have to pause, and then I start going through this process, right? So I go in and I read all these inventories, and I look at my sex conduct. I've written my sex ideal, and it says, where are we going? It's page 75. You know, it tells us who we pick this guy to read the step with. And then I just want to kind of touch on these fifth step promises here. We pocket our pride and go for it, illuminating every twist of character and every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. And sometimes, you know, that's just the knowledge. That's the ability to actually see the truth about this insanity behind alcohol and the way I've lived my life and been driven by self. Sometimes that is enough to create enough change in my life, to create enough of that experience that we call a spiritual experience. Sometimes it's the spiritual awakening, bright light thing. I've had both, and the bright light thing did not feel very good. This was just more of a gradual thing. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Now it says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Now, how the heck do I know God better after doing all this horrible stuff about me? Well, if I'm seeking truth, God is truth. Okay? And if I seek truth, I'm closer to God, because I've gotten me off of me enough. And I can see the difference between when I'm being driven by something that isn't me, an old idea, belief system, something that came from childhood programming, whatever. And the fact that I find them objectionable, the fact that I would drink behind these things, means that's not something that I would choose to do on my own. My spiritual self, right? They got the mind self, the heart self, the gut self. There's a spiritual self that kind of sees all of this stuff. And that's what I'm trying to get in touch with. I'm trying to find the difference between all of these, you know, my innermost self that it talks about in More About Alcoholism. And that's where that sentence really resonated the most with me. I'm just trying to get back to being one of God's kids. That's it. Get all this stuff off of me. Tell me how I can perform your work well and you know, stay close to you. That's, you know, it's really what it comes down to. It says, carefully reviewing the first five proposals after we take the book down from the shelf. Not really sure what that's all about, if we're actually doing this work. How's the book on the shelf? Okay. So I go back and I have people go to the page 59 where the steps are outlined. And I have people go down and I'll have little prompt sheets sometimes where I'll have them just go back through what you remember the first five steps. It could look like, am I clear that I have little to no control over how much alcohol I put in my body once I take the first drink? That the phenomenon of craving is the distinguishing characteristic that makes me an alcoholic. If I don't have it, I'm not an alcoholic. Or have not crossed the threshold of choice yet. I have a mental condition that also makes me powerless over the first drink, and that this is a hopeless condition of mind and body. Do I have that? These are the things I need to go back and, like, this is how I reconsider. I mean, is my work solid so far? This arch that we're talking about, that this relationship with this power, this keystone, is going to hold together. Has this been my experience, right? And I was so beat up this time. I wrote all this stuff out and I was like, I'm going to do this to the letter of the law because I skimped last time and I don't know what I skimped on was why I picked up a drink and blah. And I was like, I'm going to be fearless and thorough. And it was just one of those things that the fact that I was trying, whether it was perfect or not, I don't think God makes too hard of terms as long as I'm doing this process the best I can. I believe between a sponsee doing the best he can and a sponsor doing the best they can, God's going to pick up a lot of the slack in that relationship. Right? And that's just going to get me in touch with whatever power I need at the level I have it at the time I'm doing it is going to carry me to the next place so I can grow toward this power. And each time I do it, it has to get deeper. I can't survive on the experience I had the first time I went through it. I have to kind of, that's why inventory has turned into this for me, because I needed to see more. I needed to go further down the rabbit hole so I could get closer to this power. Because otherwise, the result, the way I live my life, the way I feel living my life is unacceptable to me. I didn't get sober to be low grade miserable. I didn't. And I'm not going to, you know, if that's, hey, cool, if you everybody has their own standards with it. I don't want to have this, like, measly little sober thing. Okay, I'm Eeyore. I'm going to just, you know, get through day by day, and then hopefully I'll, you know, death won't be too painful. You know, that kind of a thing. Am I clear that self-knowledge of these conditions is not enough to keep me sober? Am I clear that the solution to alcoholism is a spiritual experience? As an alcoholic, I have only two alternatives, to die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. Am I clear on that? Am I clear that if step one is not experienced on a visceral level, I will not see the seriousness of my condition? I will balk at inventory and amends. I will see steps 10 and 11 as something I can take or leave. I will not see how essential it is for me to have access to this power. That's been my experience. Step two, am I willing to lay aside prejudice, open my mind to what spiritual terms mean to me? Am I willing to go to any length to have a spiritual awakening? Pay all the money back. Sit across from people I don't want to sit across from. Am I willing to pray and meditate? Am I willing to sit down with my wife and kids on a weekly basis and say, I'm sorry again for acting like an ass, right? Am I willing to let go of my old ideas so I can have a new experience? Do I believe, or am I willing to believe, there's a power greater than me that can take me past where I am right now? Am I willing and can I can and will recover if I completely give myself to this program? And that's really hard for me to do because, like I said, I got a mind that keeps kind of drifting off going, oh, yeah, I just left the beam again. And it's just one of those things that I can't have 100% focus because the main problem lies in the mind, right? And me knowing that doesn't save me from it. It's constant vigilance of getting better at this process and turning to this process. And it's like walking around being like low-grade insane your whole life when it comes to this stuff, because I can't focus on the things I need to focus on because I get distracted, or a stage character takes the mic and I start listening to the story he's telling. You know, it's the crazy stuff that pops into my head that because I'm a... See, you can't watch and turn away from that which you're asleep to. And my whole life has been a process of waking up. And there is no place more important that I learn how to wake up than through the inventory process, you know? And just to kind of give you an example of the kind of stuff I'm dealing with here, when COVID came around. Now this, mind you, these are actual real inventories that I wrote. And this was done the same week by two different states of consciousness, written by this guy, the same guy sitting up here right now. Now, this is kind of weird. So, COVID-19, column one. Column two, making the world come to a standstill and threaten my family's well-being. Now, when I read it like this, when COVID-19 made the world stand still and threaten my family's well-being, did it hurt, threaten, or interfere with my self-esteem? So it starts to, if you read it like on these little sheets that I have, if you read it like that, it creates its own narrative. And what's funny is when I each state of being or each state of self, self-esteem, pride, I go, when COVID-19 did such and such, did it hurt, threaten, or interfere with my pride? And what it starts to do is my ego fills in the blank. And I have the questions that you ask yourself. So self-esteem is how I see or feel about myself. Usually I feel more than, I feel less than. I am fill in the blank. Did so-and-so did such-and-such that are threatening to interfere with my pride. Pride is how others see me. No one should, could, or would, right? And you fill in the blank. Ambition, security. Ambition is what I want to have happen. Security is what I need to have happen to be okay. Personal relations are my deep-seated belief about friendship, usually same-sex, or this situation. So we have all these different ways to get to understand these states of being at depth. Because like I said, we're going to be watching for these on a daily basis. So you need to know how they hit you. So when COVID-19 made the world stand still and threatened my family's well-being, did it hurt, threaten, or interfere with my self-esteem? How I see or feel about myself? I feel less than because I can't take care of me and or my family, bills, food. Fear, failure, dying, relapse, not a man, a father, or a husband. Because those stage characters, a man takes care of his family. Right? A husband should be able to take care of his wife. Right? My wife's a doctor. She makes a great living. I don't even believe that because it's not true. But yet it's on my inventory. Right? And I'm acting as though it's true. All right? So pride. When COVID-19 made the world come to a standstill, did it threaten or interfere with my pride? How others see me? No one should see me not being able to take care of my family. Ambition. What I want to have... what I want to have happen. I want to be back at work fixing the programs and making more money. Security. I need to be able to pay my bills and provide to be a good partner for my wife, not be susceptible to a lung virus due to smoking so long. Right? Because I smoked for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Personal relations. Affecting me in how I see my student and relate to people as a whole. Judging people who don't take this quarantine seriously. Pocketbook. I'm not making much money. Now in my turnaround, now this is setting up, it's almost, because I know what's coming, this is almost embarrassing. Selfish, self-pity, self-reliant, self-centered, projecting about what I could lose, fancied, loss and real loss, trying to find ways to make money and not stay in quarantine. Early on this risk I put my family, it was abhorrent. I'm trying to find all these different ways to get out during the pandemic. Right, and you remember early on, like, no, you're not supposed to go anywhere. You stay in your house only if you need to. And I'm afraid of getting. It says, where was I afraid of getting sick, not being there for my family, my son, losing the potential pay increase because I was up for a promotion right before the pandemic. Right, and I'm like, son of a, and job responsibilities, and then this and delusion. Now I'm being delusional because the virus is just a flu. Mm-hmm. Right, and so that was my resentment against COVID-19. Now, the same week, I read this stuff before I got here, and I just started laughing. I'm going, this is perfect. I have to read this. Column one, the people not staying in quarantine. Same guy, right? Putting themselves and others in jeopardy by not social distancing and staying home. So I'm basically, one stage character is writing inventory against another one of my stage characters. Are you with me on that? All right, so now, did it hurt, threaten, or interfere with my self-esteem? I feel more than because how dare they not act for the greater good? Pride. Nobody should act irresponsibly in a way that could extend this quarantine and all its money and health effects. Do you see the high horse I'm on? Ambition. I don't want to have to be locked up any longer than is necessary. Security. I need to have people act the right way in order for me to feel safe about my family's well-being. Jesus. Pocketbook. I'm not going to get asked back next week. This is just pocketbook. Not working, paying credit and paying bills. Personal relations. Real men and women should be willing to do what is necessary to alleviate the threat of their families and others. Spiritual pride. That's what wrote that. Spiritual pride. I'm up here, you know. Selfish, feel sorry for myself, self-pity. Katie and Charlie are always just like, anytime you get self-pity, try to read it and like, I want to feel better than them for doing the right thing. You know, you say it in that voice, in that self-pity voice, and you're just like, oh, man. Self-centered, feel like I shouldn't have to be inconvenienced, afraid of getting sick, my family getting sick, losing. You know, none of this stuff has any basis in reality. And when I start to write inventory, you see by the time I get to the fourth column, I start to laugh it off. Yeah. You know, and that's where the freedom is. And that's where this tool is. I'm going to read you guys one more, and this one's kind of bothered me my son, who was 7 at the time, who was almost 10, at the beginning of the pandemic, was too afraid to let the dentist fill his cavity. He's freaking out screaming, okay, at the dentist. People, like kids, are looking around the corner. This is how bad it is, right? And my wife sees this happen, and there's this vein that comes out of my forehead, and she basically saw it, and she just was like, I got it. Go ahead. And I'm going through column one and column two, walking to the car, already writing the inventory against my 7-year-old son. This is how selfish and self-centered I am. It says, when Dylan was too afraid to let the dentist fill his cavity, did it hurt, threaten, or interfere with my self-esteem? I feel less than because my son is afraid to let a dentist do his job. Pride. Nobody should see me unable to teach my son how to be okay when afraid. Personal relations. A father should equip his son with life skills so they can deal with uncomfortable situations. Ambition. I want to be and be seen as a good father that raises a well-behaved and adjusted child. Good luck with that. Self-seeking. Tried to force my will on Dylan to resolve it. Selfish. I want Dylan to get through difficulty so I look like I know how to raise a well-adjusted child. None of this is about him. Every bit of it is about me and how I feel and how I want the situation to be different. You know, we are self-seekers even when trying to be kind, right? Look at the motives here, right? This is how I show up when I'm asleep, when something happens out in the world, out in the, what I call the wild. Self-righteous, this will be good for him, and I'm there for you as long as I get my payoff. That one hurts. Self-pity, one more thing I fail at. Self-centered, his fear is about me and my issues and fears, not the fact that it's his first cavity and drills and needles are scary.
Yeah.
Right? Self-reliant, I'm going to make the situation resolve itself and look like I actually know what I'm doing. Dishonesty to myself, thinking I'm disappointed and ashamed of my son when it's me. Delusion for thinking I was there for support unselfishly or that I have any power over my son and his feelings. Afraid my son will struggle in life and be a wuss. Didn't write that, but fear of being seen by my family as a loser that doesn't know what he is doing as a father or a man in general. That's what I got going on up there, right? And if I don't write that stuff down, and if I don't get free of that, that stuff owns me. And this is the process. And the great thing is I can sit here and read it in front of all you guys, and it doesn't bother me a bit because I'm free of it. I've dealt with all these things that, I mean, it made me wake up to what a man is, how I'm supposed to be there emotionally. I mean, I had to grow up in a lot of different ways over this pandemic. And I thought I was doing the deal. Going to meetings, sponsoring guys, doing evening review. And this basically brought me to my knees and showed me all the holes in my program. Now, I could have gone one direction and, you know, and just gone off the deep end. But I sat down and I started doing all this work because I had 20 hours a day to do it. And I needed to stay out of me. So I started going to this process and talking to my sponsor and doing these 10 steps. And, you know, it got into two-way prayer and it got into all these other things. And I started reaching out into God's toolbox because the one I had wasn't enough. And as I started to go through this process, it showed me new rooms that I could go into and broaden and deepen this process. And I learned that starting with inventory. So hopefully I'll try to get you guys into amends and everything next week. So thanks. That's all I got.